My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date's August 3rd, 2013. And for a lot of you guys, I've been around here a lot longer than that, and I'll get into that. These last 3.5 years have been truly a blessing for me, as all the other times, too, the years I've spent in AA. The first sobriety date I had was November 26, 1989, and I stayed sober a really long time, but I'll get into what happened along the way, and that, you know, alcohol didn't have anything to do with it. But I was raised in Connecticut, middle-class family, good family. I had one of the first pools in town. My dad built it himself. He built four stone walls. He had the hole dug. He built four stone walls. They had a mason come in and fill it up with concrete, and they painted it blue, and they put in the piping, and, you know, we had all 6 acres of land, so we had baseball in the summer. We had football in the winter and in the fall, and we had basketball in the winter, and everyone came to our house. We had a lot of fun there. There were a lot of parties there. Parents had a lot of parties. I learned about what a keg was early on. I liked to pump it up. I always got yelled at because I always pumped it up too much, but, you know, I was a little OCD. Of course, they didn't have the letters back then of what you were. You were just hyper back then. And, yeah, I had a really good upbringing of loving parents. They were married 54 years before my dad passed in 2004 and my mom in 2011. And I was sober for both of them, which is a true blessing to be accountable and be able to show up. I grew up, had a lot of friends. Right from the very, very beginning, though, I didn't seem to fit. I was either a follower or a leader. I was never one of many. And so when I came here just to be another drunk, it was very, very difficult because I was a special drunk, you know. There was nothing ordinary about me, so I thought. You know, being run-of-the-mill was not a word I liked, and being a garden-variety drunk was not what I represented. And, you know, so coming here to be one of many was something I had to learn. And I'm glad I learned it, because one of many is the softer, easier way for sure. Grew up and got terrible grades in high school. I remember Mrs. Mondani, my second-grade teacher, said, if Jim knew that standing on his head would get him a laugh, he would stand on his head all day. And that's the kind of person I was. I was very, very outgoing, and I think to hide insecurities that I had. So, you know, if you put it out there, people won't know that what you're feeling inside. And I was really, really good at that. And once you get in here, that can be really detrimental, you know, when you get that good. But we are all role players, I think, one way or the other. We learn that, and we protect our drinking that way. You know, I got my first surgery when I was 12 years old. I had both my eyes operated on, that amblyopia, whatever they call that, lazy eye. And, you know, I was introduced to the pain medicine there, and I felt it and liked it. And so I realized that I liked things that made me feel different than what I normally was. And that was my first experience. And growing up, we had sips. You know, you had sips on the beer, you know. And my dad used to do that, and there were three of us. I had an older brother, a younger brother, and then 14 years later, a younger sister. But most of the time, it was just my older brother and my younger brother. And we would have sips, and my dad would bring out his Kruger Pilsner, and would say, can we have a sip? And when it got to the point when there was this much left at the bottom of it before he got it, then we stopped getting sips. But we all seemed to like it. Like I said, I didn't get very good grades. I was the class clown, you know, that's what I got voted as, matter of fact. I was asked to speak at our 25th high school reunion. I was the guest speaker, and I was voted class clown and most changed person. I had 5 years of sobriety at that time at my graduation, and I was voted the most changed person. And there was good reason for that, for sure, because they'd never seen me breathe a sober breath all through high school. I picked up my first drink at 13. Actually, the first time was 9. I was going around taking champagne glasses off wedding tables, you know, where they didn't sit. They had placements for everybody, but people didn't show up or whatever. And I would drink those, and I remember how that felt. But I don't count that because that was just an opportunity. The first time I planned my first drunk and stole the booze to get it, because at 13 they don't sell you alcohol, I was at a neighbor's house. And it was Christmas time, and we were celebrating the holidays. My parents were downstairs. There was a pool room and a bar down there. And they also had a little cabinet upstairs that was full of alcohol. And I needed to steal some because I had some older friends I wanted to impress. I knew they drank. And so I was looking for something they wouldn't miss. And all I could do was equate it to things that I knew about. I didn't like vodka because this was like 68 or 69 somewhere, 67, 66, let's see, 13, 65. And, you know, the missile Cuban crisis, the Russians, so vodka was out. I heard they drank that, so I didn't like that. And then there was rye, and I didn't like rye bread, so that was out. And gin, and then that's a card game, and I wasn't interested. But I saw this thing called scotch, and I liked butterscotch. So I said, this is the one I'm going to steal. Now, I wanted to steal something they wouldn't miss, and it was way in the back, and it had dust on it. And I didn't quite understand it, but, you know, I was looking for that thing that said Made Fresh Tuesday. I wasn't going to take that, but I took the one that said 50-year-old scotch, because who wanted to drink something that's 50 years old? It didn't make any sense to a 13-year-old. I figured no one's going to miss this. So that's what I stole. And back in those days, when you bought peanut butter, they had the cups on the side. And when you're done with the peanut butter, you could actually use them as a measuring cup for laundry and stuff like that. And I remember I had a two-cupper. And I filled that thing up, and it just fit that top. And back then it was James Bond and Goldfinger and Thunderball and all that. And that was the big rage back then, going to the movie theaters. And I felt like that, hiding this booze so no one would call. You hear dun 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 dun, you know, and I'm just running around and hiding this booze. My motive is to make these new friends that were older than I was. We decided to go camping in Connecticut in February, Cockaponsett State Forest. And my mom said, no, 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 we don't want him to go. And my father said, I'll make a man out of him. So I got to go. And so all that stuff, right before we left for the camping trip, I asked the question to one of the guys who were even older than the guys I was trying to befriend. I said, will this get me drunk? And he just said yes. So my mind started thinking, and after all that work, I decided that I wasn't going to share this with anybody because he didn't say how many it would get drunk. He just said it would get me drunk. So I chug-a-lugged it in 15 minutes, the whole thing, two cups of 50-year-old scotch, and immediately started project vomiting and went into hypothermia. It was like 6 degrees out on the lake. There was about a foot and a half of ice. They had to dig down so they'd get me some water to hydrate me. And everybody gave me their sleeping bags and tried to keep me warm. And I'm puking all over everything. And when I got back to school, I was the guy who drank all that scotch. And I was a hero. I mean, people recognized me. I did something apparently pretty important to these older guys. And I became their test project. If they had a pill or a drink, they weren't sure what it was going to do, give one to Jim, see what happens. And if he lives, we'll take one. And it really became like that. So I got invited, and I got my wish. All these older people were inviting the mascot, me, to come into their parties and watch me fall down. I was their little muse at the time. And I enjoyed the attention. And so I'd only been drinking a year. It was May 2nd, 1970. We decided that we were going to go water skiing. It was still freshet season, for you guys that don't know, in the Connecticut River. It's got a very strong current in the beginning of the year, and it pulls trees into the water, and they float, and they get waterlogged, and they go below the water line. But they're all out there all the time, and it's very dangerous for boats. And we were skiing along, and we hit one of those about 35 miles an hour. Now, that day, I thought maybe I would drive the boat or I would ski, and I had a wetsuit on that was 4 sizes too big for me. They used me for ballast because I was still drunk from the night before and I wasn't feeling that good, but I knew there was supposed to be more drinking there, so I dragged myself out of bed at 9 in the morning and got to where I was supposed to be, and we went on it. Well, we hit this log, and I was on the bow of the boat and went over the front of the bow. The boat came down on top of me. My wetsuit got caught in the propeller and it dragged me in. I don't know if you can see it from here. It's been a long time, but 125 stitches just in these two, cut both my lips down where this lip was underneath my chin, this lip was over my nose, and snapped my legs and cut this finger off. And I was stuck on Selden's Island for 2.5 hours before this guy came by on a boat with his niece, a little aluminum boat. And I ended up many months in the hospital, intensive care for 3 weeks and guarded care for 6 weeks, and then a body cast up to here, both legs with a bar going across, flat on my back, called a spica bed, where there's a, it's a canvas bed with a hole for you know what. And, you know, I don't know if you go in the bathroom, can be a chore for anybody, but when you're flat on your back and you're not moving, it was like having a baby every 3 days, and it was not fun. And back then, and we didn't have air conditioning in Connecticut, you know, there was no need for it. And it was a tough time. And I got all the attention again. You know, when I was in intensive care, they would bring McDonald's, which was a big deal. Even back in the 60s and 1970, McDonald's had only been around for maybe 10 or 11 years, 12 years, you know, late 50s or whatever. And they were starting to pop up more. And they would show up with a large McDonald's milkshake full of beer. And because all my food was coming through a straw anyhow, that really worked well. And when you mix it with the morphine they were giving me, it was just fantastic. And you could smoke in those days. I was only 13, but I was smoking, and if someone came in, I would try to hide it. And, you know, I got permission in the house when I was 14 because my parents didn't want me burning the house down. And so I grew up crooked. I have orthopedic shoes. Now I have an artificial hip. You know, my back grew up like a corkscrew. I was out of gym. You know, none of that stuff would happen. And so I squeaked barely through high school and got a factory job like everybody in my town did. They got some kind of work. I worked at Pratt Reed, started off making pianos, and then I worked at R.R. Donnelly's driving a fork truck for a couple years, and then ended up as a machinist at Pratt Whitney in Middletown, Connecticut, and I became a machinist. And I did all that. In between that, I met my future ex-wife, my first one, and we played house, and she saw very quickly that I was not husband material. You know, I was a professional motocross mechanic, and I used to race bikes and wasn't very good at it. I was actually a danger to myself and others, but I was a pretty good mechanic, so I was hired to do the pro circuit, and I would tour with these guys at supercrosses and motocrosses, and left my wife home on the weekend, and she got tired of that and found somebody else, which I was infuriated. How dare she? But, you know, after you get sober, you look back at things, and you realize that, you know, things are the way they are because of my behavior, not her behavior. And it's tough lessons learned. Anyhow, in all those years, people at all the factories said, "You're a funny guy. You're a funny guy." And I heard that all the time because that was what I did. I cracked people up. So at one point, there was an amateur comedy contest at the Logger and Lantern in Niantic, Connecticut, which was a stripper club. And I got dared, which you don't do to an alcoholic, to enter this contest for $100 first place. And I went in there. It was 81. And I won. And so I entered four or five more. Now, if you're not familiar with this area, New London, Niantic area, Norwich, it's Navy bases. You know, there's submarines, electric boat, they build the submarines. Lots of Navy people. So a lot of stripper clubs. And so they had a place for the male and female dancers, the halftime entertainment to kind of cool things down and, you know, everything else. So they'd have a stand-up comic come out, and that was me. And around that time, I was still working as a machinist. At this time, I was working at Wyndham Aircraft. I was working on helicopter motors. The helicopters would crash. They'd take the motor out. We'd repair it, and we'd test it and sell it. And that's what our jobs were. But now I'm at this, doing this stand-up comedy for $75 a night, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all the drinks you can drink, which, you know, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. And people coming up to you and saying, "Hey, you're funny. Can I buy you a drink?" My parents said, you know, you always, you know, be polite and finish whatever they give you, you know, like your meal or a drink. I don't think they ever said drink, but that's the way I interpreted it anyhow. So I made sure that I never left anything on the table, that especially the free ones. And that be presented a problem of getting home because I'd get in that car and I was pretty sideways. I'd have $75 in my pocket, I didn't pay a penny for a drink, and I was just looped. And I got introduced to something, it was the 80s, and it was Studio 54 around that time, and there was this stuff going around, which I called today my higher powder. And I found out that if you do a little of this, it'll wake you up and you can get home without any problem. And you don't have to worry about DUIs and all that. Problem was, it used to cost me, you know, I'd get paid $75 to do the show. It cost me $100 to get home and $100 to get to work. And at the end of the month, I'm looking and I don't have any money. And, you know, I didn't think I had a drug or alcohol problem. I thought I had a math problem. I just could not figure out what was going on. But I spent a lot of money on this already, and it only got worse as it got worse. And so from there, it quickly snowballed into maybe Jim has a problem. At Wyndham Aircraft, every morning we'd be there at 6:30 for to start work at 7, and there was a guy there named Danny, and Danny would read this little black book about this big. And he'd have a big cup of coffee, and he'd drink coffee all day long. And the thing that Danny did that nobody ever did at 7 o'clock in the morning is he had a big smile on his face, and he'd say, "Hi, how you doing?" And I wanted what he had, but I didn't know what it was, you know. But Danny was sober, and I didn't know that. What also I didn't know is Danny was pigeon hunting, and I didn't know that either. So on a particularly bad day, he said to me in 1988, he said, he asked me the three questions. Do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I was pretty tore up that morning, and I said, yeah. He goes, do you want some help? Now, I didn't know Danny was an AA at this point. I just knew he was one of the happiest guys I've ever seen. Now, I've tried every drug and drink under the sun, but nothing could make me happy like Danny was happy. And he said, do you want some help? Now, I interpreted it the only way I think, you know. The help I needed was, you know, a little, you know, bump or a little, you know, something. So I said, yeah. And he goes, do you want it now? And I'm going, whoa, this is, yeah. And I'm thinking, this is great. Whatever Danny's doing, I'm going to get some. And he goes, I got to talk to the boss. And I'm going, whoa, the boss is in on it. This is incredible. So it's like 10 in the morning, and he comes out, let's go. And right now, I thought we were going to meet somebody at noon in the parking lot, you know, and it's 10 o'clock and we're getting into a station wagon. It's February, and I was so excited I didn't even take my coat. Just got in that freezing car, and we get on the road, and I'm thinking, what could it be? What could it be? You know, and we pull up to this building that's painted purple, and it's called the Murphy House. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, I've copped at a lot of places, but that is the strangest, most stuck-out looking building I've ever seen. You know, and we went in there, and I couldn't figure it out. On the wall, it's saying, first things first, and the easy does it. And I'm going, oh, that's a phonics thing, like reading is fundamental. I've seen those before, you know. Still not knowing why I'm there and what's going on. And then we go into this office, and this guy starts talking about sobriety. And I said, oh, man, what have I done? My mom at this point was newly sober. She'd had about 8 or 9 months. And then alcoholism comes freely in our family. And we're very connected that way in our family and near family. And for some strange reason, I ended up in a place in Bloomfield, Connecticut, and believe it or not, not knowing I'd ever moved down here, it was called Blue Ridge Rehab Center. And a little prophetic thing there. And when I went in there, they took my blood pressure, and they gave me Valium. And then they took my blood pressure like another hour, and then they gave me Librium. And then they took my blood pressure again, and they gave me more Valium. And I'm staring at my shoelaces, and I'm thinking, well, sobriety. If this is sobriety, I think I can handle it, you know, because I was feeling nothing at this point. I was just completely zoned out. Well, in that room, and it was a crowded room, across the way was this young lady. And they say the sickest man and the sickest woman in a crowded room will inevitably find each other. And I did. And we made eye contact, and apparently she knew who I was. I was in the paper a lot. It's doing radio stuff. I was at a TV commercial called Corporate Connection Limousine Service. Doesn't matter if you're a funny man or a businessman, Corporate Connection's got the ride for you. And it was on the TV all the time. And when you grow up in a small town, you're getting ribbed all the time. Or people coming up to you in the bar and going, yeah, Corporate Connection, man, I get a thump. Where does that go? You know, it was happening all the time. So we decided after a few minutes, we talked each other out of being there. And so we left. She got in her BMW and drove back to her big house, and I hitchhiked back to where I work without a coat. Because remember, I left without a coat, and it's still February. And I went and I made all the great decisions. I went to my job and quit, got my last paycheck, and went down to the projects and picked up some of my higher powder and a quart of Absolut, which was what I was drinking at the time. Absolut and grapefruit juice. And I didn't have any grapefruit juice because I had made a decision recently. I had gone into the bar. I started bleeding. You know, in the morning I was in the toilet and was in the sink, and blood was coming up through both ends. And I realized at that point that it had to do with my drinking. So I made a decision, and when I went to the bar, my drink was already sitting there, Absolut and grapefruit juice. And I said, nope, I can't do that anymore. I got to cut out the grapefruit juice. That stuff is tearing my stomach up. And they all said, wow, Jim's taking care of himself. Good guy, you know. And so I drank Absolut on the rocks and thought I was doing a great thing because, you know, we don't want to bleed all out, and you know, because of that. So anyhow, something happened that day. The higher powder didn't work, and the alcohol didn't kick in, and it was very, very strange feeling. Me and her start talking on the phone, her from her house and me from my little flop house where I was living. And I was making good money by this time and working regular days and evenings, but I never had any because my tastes were expensive. And me and her started talking to each other, and when I got off the phone, I felt like we were talking about not drinking. That's what we were talking about. We were talking about going to some of these meetings that they were talking about. We hadn't been to any yet. And we were talking about how difficult it will be and how maybe we can do it together and this stuff. And I got up off the phone from this woman, and I felt that I was in love for the first time in my life. There was this feeling that I never had felt before, the closeness, the connection. It was just a beautiful thing. I didn't know till later it was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic about not drinking. I didn't know that. I just thought it was love. And she had got to that detox about an hour before I did, and I heard you had to have a sponsor. So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes, which I thought was very nice of her. And because the phone calls back then were expensive, I asked her to move in with me. So instead of having to call her now, I just had to nudge her. And all this time, we hadn't been to a meeting yet, but we decided to do that. And she became my stand-up manager. And I come and found out that she had a lot of money. She was worth a lot of money. I didn't know that when I met her. Excuse me, just for 1 second. Take a drink. Just coffee. And so we move in together, and we decided to go to meetings. So we went to Deep River, Tuesday night, 8:30, candlelight meeting. And we went in there, and there are these two older people. I thought they were the owners of that group, Norman and Dora May. And they were the grand poupas. They had 100 years apiece or something. And we would just sit there. We wouldn't say anything. But we were in awe of what people were saying in these meetings. I mean, we were taught, you never say stuff like that out in public. People are talking about their feelings. People are talking about some of the things they've done. And people are laughing when they're done. And we're going, what is so funny? You know, it was like, oh my God, did you just hear what she said she did with those guys? I mean, it's like, oh my God, you know, telling their stories. So we came back the next week just to, you know, it was like soap opera for us. We were worried about the sobriety part. We wanted to hear what happened next, you know. It was like we couldn't believe it. It was like stay tuned. So we went to that one meeting every week not knowing there were more. And she became my manager, and we got new headshots. And what she did is she didn't want me playing at these places that I was making money at. And I didn't want her going because of the clientele. So behind my back, she auditioned me to the top comedy clubs on the East Coast. Didn't tell me. And then told me. I was furious because I had my little niche, you know. I was quite happy, you know. But I did. And I auditioned, you know, the top comedy clubs and some in New York. And you've heard of all the names. And I won, you know, passed those auditions. And I went from burlesque and stripper clubs to top comedy clubs. And I had a show one night. It was with I think of his name. He did a show called Rescue Me. He was it'll come to me. Anyhow, I was playing with this guy down in Norwich, Connecticut, and I had a show. This is a place I used to drink at, and Kathy was going home to get some of her stuff. She was moving this stuff down, and I did the show and picked up a drink that night, and When I woke up in the morning, there was a ceiling fan over my head, and I know I don't have a ceiling fan in my house, and I looked over, and it wasn't Kathy next to me, and I was just, that first feeling ever of that impending doom, that feeling of remorse, you know, the first time I felt a consequence from my drinking, and I felt horrible. And this was in, you know, the early 80s, so there's no cell phones, and that Monday, she hadn't returned, and my mom called me and said, how you guys doing? I said, good. Dennis Leary, that's the guy I did. He was headline, and I opened up for him that particular night. And I said, good, good, good. And she goes, how's Kathy? And I said, well, it's weird. She's not here. And she goes, oh, well, okay, all right, you know. And so come Thursday, they called me again and said, how's everything? And I said, well, Kathy's not here. She goes, well, we want to talk to you. Can you come over? My mom had like 2 years at that particular time, maybe a little less than that. And I said, you know, it was like 20 minutes, 20 miles or whatever to my parents' house from where I was living. And I said, well, just tell me, you know, I'm on the phone here. You know, no, we'd really like to tell you. Your dad and I would like to talk to you. And I said, all right, yeah, so just, And I get in the car and I drive over there and they sat me down and I felt like, you know, back in high school, like I got bad grades or something. It was like you could feel the tension in the room. Well, Monday they saw a woman pulled from burning car and it had her hometown, which was a unique name of a town, and my mom recognized it right away. And Thursday they had identified it was Kathy through dental records because she got drunk the same night. And she hit a tree and got pinned in her car and it caught on fire and she burned to death. And I don't get the newspaper. My parents did. My mom, she was like, when I got in that boat accident, she could hear the ambulance on the other side of the Connecticut River. She went right to Middlesex Memorial Hospital. Now, I ended up going to New London Hospital, but she knew right away. You know, moms are weird like that. She knew it was me in that accident. She knew for sure. And as soon as this all went down, she knew what this was about when she saw a woman pulled from burning car and saw the name of that town. And I promised she wanted me to stay there, and I said, no, I'll be fine. And she goes, she didn't want me to drink, obviously. And so, you know, I did. And I went to the bank to see if I had 20 bucks so I could get some gas for my car. And like a big shot, having a checking account, it was probably one of the first ones I ever had because of her. I said, what's my balance? And she said, oh, it's $49,980. She put $50,000 in my checking account for incidentals for my comedy career in case we needed it. And then, of course, she passed away, and I don't know any of her family. And by the way, she was still married. And so this complicated things, and my parents didn't know that. And we went to the funeral, and the tension in that room was pretty bad because, you know, my face was everywhere. It was in papers, and it was on TV. It was on, my voice was on the radio, and her husband was looking at me the whole time they walked around. And, of course, obviously, it was closed casket. So it was, like, really tense, and I just told my parents, really don't want to go to the grounds where the, you know. And so they said, okay, we just went to the memorial service and we left. But it was intense, to say the least. But they didn't know what was going on. They know after, you know, years of sobriety, I told them. But and so I started going through that money. And in 6-7 months, I had spent that $50,000 on my higher powder and alcohol and being a big shot. Cases of Dom Perignon, you know, being the big shot, you know, by the bar around several times or whatever, you know. I'm a big celebrity, you know. Everyone knows who I am, you know. I was dying inside, but I couldn't tell anybody that because I had to put this big front on that I'd learned all my life, not to show fear, not to show things were bad. And I remember one night, I did a show. It was a sellout show, and I had a lot of them, and I was very fortunate that way. I just was blessed with being able to talk like this, just nonstop, and, you know, I think of stupid things to say, which are lifelike, and people can relate to them, and that's what comics are. That's all they are. They take the silly things we do, and they put it in your face when you've had a couple drinks, and it's funny. And that's all it is. And the limo driver was taking me home because I had free limousine rides for the comics that I hired for my shows, which came later, and for myself. And I was so embarrassed about where I lived, I had him drop me off in front of this really nice house, and then I walked a half a mile to where I lived because I could not show a guy I've never met before and would never meet again, who was making minimum wage driving a limo, that I lived in a crap hole because that's all I could afford, and because I spent all my money getting high and drinking. And that's the kind of person I was. You know, I was the biggest phony in the world. And it's really, when you come in here and you have that kind of mentality, it's really hard getting sober, you know, because you can't let your guard down. You just, it's been, you know, in your brain. So after that money was gone, deciding not to rob this store one night, that's where it brought me, to outside this Cumberland Farms with a knife and a sweater that I cut the arm off, cut two holes in it, decided I was going to rob this place, which I've never done anything like this in my entire life. And I put the sweater on, but the eyes were in the back, and I'm really drunk, so now I'm like this, and the car doesn't have an emergency brake, so I keep hitting the brake on the car because I think I'm rolling, and of course the lights are blinking on and off like hazards, and this is my getaway car. And finally I just, thank God I came to my senses. I couldn't get the sweater off because I couldn't find a hat, so I just took the, cut a sweater off and jammed it over my head, but the eyes were in the back. That's where it brought me. And thank God that didn't go down. And I knew the girl who was the clerk. I mean, that's, and it was across the street from the Deep River Police Station. That's another thing I probably should tell you. You know, not really thought through. But I was that bad off, you know. I was that bad off. And I ended up at that Tuesday night candlelight meeting on 8:30 after that 6 or 7 months. And before that meeting was over, I was on my way to Stonington Institute, which is a rehab center. Not because they were nice, not because they think I was a great guy. They thought I was going to die in the meeting, and that's what they told me later. They didn't think I was going to make it. I yelled at this guy because he wouldn't move his leg. He had his legs out like this, and I'm trying to get through the aisle, and I said, what the hell's the matter with you? Move your leg. He had a broken leg, and he had a cast on, you know. I didn't even see it. You know, I was a mess, and I woke up in this place, Stonington Institute, and that first go-around, I concentrated for 30-some-odd days on who was going to make it, who the phonies were, who wasn't getting it, and I was probably the first one drunk, probably 15 days out of there. Might have been less. I don't know. And I became AA's poster child. They would stand me up at the front entrance, and people would go, excuse me, is this AA? Yeah, it is. You know, they'd walk by me, and, you know, they could smell my problem. They could see my problem, you know. And I was just, you know, as a rebel without a clue. And but I had no place to go. I had burned all my bridges. My parents were not on good speaking terms with me. My brothers and sisters weren't. And that's what we do. We burn all our bridges, and then we go back and make sure we burn them a little more. And so AA was the only place I'd go, and God did that for me. He really did. My higher power made it so there was no other avenues. So there was no other income. I was unemployable. There was nothing I could do but go to AA because that was the only one people would say welcome. You know, nobody else was saying, come on in. Everybody else was saying, get the hell out. And that happened a lot. I'd stop at friends' houses to tell them how sorry I was. And if you ever get to the ninth step, which I did, I told my sponsor, I said I was having trouble with one of the steps. He goes, which one? And Glenn, God bless him, he stuck with me through the whole time. And he's a saint, still sober today, many, many years. And I said, I'm having a problem with one of the steps. He goes, which one? I said, the ninth step. He goes, you might want to stop drinking before you do that one, Jim. You know, because I hadn't stopped drinking. I was going to AA. You know, I was making coffee, but I couldn't stay sober. I had enough white chips to tile a bathroom. I mean, I was really a mess because I couldn't get honest with myself because I'd have to tell you who I was. And I've been a phony my whole life, you know. I've been running my whole life and running from the truth and who I was and who I thought I was. And I was good at it. You know, and that was the problem. I was really good at it. So finally, I got some sobriety. And at 6 months, I moved down here because I got laid off again from work. And every time I got laid off, and it was like every 4 years, they'd, you know, where'd my job go? Went to Norfolk, Connecticut, Virginia. Where'd my job go? Went to Virginia. So I said, well, I got a cousin who lives in Amosville, and I'll stay there and apply. And if I finally get a job, I'll move down here. Well, I came to Warrenton, And I just fell in love with the place. And I didn't have a job. And I went to the Monday night NFL, and Mike H., redhead, says, any visitors? And I said, yeah, I'm Jim from Connecticut. I said, welcome. And I had 6 months, and I was first pink cloud, I think I was on. You know, I was feeling good. And he goes, we need a coffee maker. And I raised my hand and said, I'll take it. And they're all looking at me like, that's a long commute to make coffee, my friend. But I knew I was moving here. And so I had a home group and a coffee job, a service position, before I had a real job or a place to live. I got all those things after. And I stayed sober. Give me a second. And it was wonderful. Because I started feeling the benefits of being sober, you know, because I did a fourth and a fifth step. I told the truth the second time. The first time I put down all the rocks except the big rock. I had to go back and drop the other rock later on, but I did. Because I was afraid I was going to drink. And at that time, I wanted to be more sober than I was more drunk. I wanted to be sober. I liked the way it felt. I loved the people. I still do. I came in here tonight, and I recognized at least six or seven, and I knew three. And, you know, I haven't been to this meeting in a year. And that's the beauty of AA, you know. That's the beauty of it. So I stayed sober for 13 years and had service positions, and I was at the podium when I was asked because people asked. And I loved it. And at that time, I was taking a lot of ibuprofen. As you know, in 1980, I also got in a motorcycle accident, broke my hip in 13 places, my elbow in two, and I got in that motorboat accident almost 13 days apart. And it was both in May. In 1970, I had snapped my legs, and, you know, the femur is your growth bone, so I stopped growing. And the back, anyhow, arthritis set in. My back was fused with arthritis, and I was on ibuprofen, big amounts. And I burned a hole in my stomach and my large intestine from the ibuprofen because I was walking around a cripple. And I'm a laborer. That's what I did. There's no machining jobs, by the way, in Warrenton, you know, that I could get a hold of. Actually, I did find one at Johnson Tool and Die in Manassas. Thank God for Mr. Ed there. I worked there for a while. But for the most part, I was a laborer, and I was in pain. And so I take ibuprofen until it burned a hole in my stomach, and the doctor said, we're going to put you on this other medicine called Percocet. And I can tell you right now and look you right in the face and say I absolutely didn't have a problem with that stuff whatsoever until I did. And when I did, it wasn't chasing the pain anymore. It was chasing the pill. And this is AA, but this is a problem among alcoholics, and that's why I mention it. It's as we get older, you know, I heard getting old is not for sissies. Anybody that's older than 50 knows exactly what I'm talking about. Things change, you know, and I found this very convenient, this pill, and I could get as many as I wanted and did. And didn't think I was doing anything wrong. It was a legal prescription. I was taking it for the most part, except for justification when I was in a little extra pain or I was going somewhere or, you know, convenience. You know, justification is a big thing in my life, and I have to be very careful of it. But I didn't have a problem with it until I did. And I went in, and when I picked up that 24-hour chip at the Clover Group, at my home group, you could have heard a pin drop. Because I went to seven meetings a week, and I was in service, and I made coffee, and I was sponsoring a half a dozen people. But the back of that chip said, to thy own self be true. I knew at that point that I was in trouble. It wasn't with alcohol. But if you're feeling the same way, no matter what it is, and you're not feeling spiritual, and you're not feeling healthy, and you know it's got you, it's got you. You know, and it doesn't matter whether if it's a liquid or a solid. You know, I can't fool myself. I picked up that new chip and went 7 years and still taking the medicine, but I took it just the way I was supposed to. And then after that 7 years, I went off the rails again. Tolerance, this and that. And you'd say, well, this is the second time he's learned his lesson. No, did it again. And this time I'm going to take it exactly the way it is. And I went 4 years, so 13, 7, and 4. This last time, my body was in such bad shape. You know, the arthritis, I mean, I've got issues going on right now, matter of fact, with orthopedic surgeons and this and that. But 3.5 years ago, I got to that point again where it was the choice of killing myself or taking another pill. It was just like with the alcohol, and I got to that point with the alcohol. If I take one more of those things, it's going to kill me. And if I don't take one more of those things, it's going to kill me. And that's where I got. And I decided to go cold turkey. And this last time, in the second day into a four-day detox, I had one of my good friends banging on my door, and I wouldn't let him in the house. And the reason was, is I picked up alcohol to get through this detox because it was hellish. It was hellish. And I hadn't tasted alcohol in a long, long time, you know, and it scared the hell out of me. And I picked up another 24-hour chip right away. That was 3.5 years ago. I haven't had a pain pill, and I haven't had a drink in those last 3.5 years. And I know, even though people are in a lot of pain, and I'm not your doctor, and I'm not telling you what you should do or shouldn't do, but a second opinion is always helpful. And for somebody like me, a third or a fourth opinion probably wouldn't hurt. I'm just a person that cannot self-medicate. And so that's why I have these different sobriety dates. I went a long time because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding, because I drank every day, and I should be drinking every day. That's what I do. That's and what I'm best at, I think. Probably a few other things I'm pretty good at, but drinking I was very good at. And because of AA, I wasn't drinking. But the pain was real. And but this last time around, I'll tell you just a little quick something with it. When you take too much of this stuff, and I know this is AA, and I'll digress right after that, something happens to your kidneys and your liver where they get enlarged because you're taking large quantities of it. It happens with alcohol, too. And so I have lower back pain. And what I found was the medicine was actually causing the lower back pain, a lot of it, not all of it, obviously. I'm in pain right now, and that's the way it is. And I took ibuprofen before I came here. So the problem I had before is I always ate pills because I some kind of a macho thing or something. I never needed water to swallow anything, and I swallowed pills all through the 60s and 70s. So I would swallow the ibuprofen. You know, I'd have them in my pocket, and I'd just swallow them and go on. Well, you're supposed to drink them with water. You know, and I never did. And it burned a hole in my stomach because of it, because I didn't hydrate when I was taking these things. So now I do it exactly the way I'm supposed to. I drink an 8-ounce glass of water when I take ibuprofen. So before, I was up all night with pain. And now I'm all up all night peeing. So nothing's really changed. I'm still up all night, but they're for two different reasons, you know. And that's getting older too, folks. You know how that goes. So I take a lot of trips in the evening, but it helps me with my sleep. I'm in service today. I'm in service right now because I was asked to do it. This is not the place I like to be because I have spoken a lot of places. And because, you know, some people can speak freer and feel more comfortable. I've always been comfortable behind a microphone. I did it for a long time. I opened up for Rodney Dangerfield and Tommy Hertz, who's the head writer for Spin City and 2.5 Men. And I've opened up for a lot of top comics all over. I grew up with Chris Rock and those guys. We hung out. And I know all those guys. And they're still doing it because they didn't drink like I did. And I knew that if I didn't get out of that business, I was going to die. One night I was doing a show, and someone brought in some Broadway lights. And the Broadway lights are hot. And they're supposed to be way up in the air, and this was a 10-foot ceiling, and they're like this far from my face. I was actually getting a tan from them. They're that hot. And I was just sweating, and it was a sold-out show. At this particular time, because all the things I went through, I started my own show, the Jimmy Lagasse and Friends Comedy Show, and it toured all over New England and Philadelphia all the way around. And, I mean, it was just bizarre, wonderful. I was making money hand over foot, sober. It was great. And I had my own lighting and my own sound crew and all that. Well, this particular night, they didn't want to pay for the extras because I charged for all that stuff. And so they said they'd bring in their own stuff. And they had Broadway lights. And I'm dying up there. You know, I was so mad at this guy. And, you know, I fly in comics from wherever they were, California, come on out and do a show for me. And we get them hotel and limo because I had that connection with the corporate connection limousine service. And I'm doing this show, and I'm just sweating to death. And this guy comes up, and he puts a nice cold Budweiser right on the stage, and he goes, "Good man," like that. And I look down, and right when I look, there was a piece of ice, and it broke off the neck, and it slid down, and it puddled right below that bottom of that beer. Now, I'm in front of 150 people. It's sold out. They paid $17.50, and this is in the early 90s for a show. And I looked up, and I went, I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was supposed to say. All I was doing was looking at that beer, and I was thirsty. Blew me away. It scared me half to death. You're supposed to get a joke out or a mannerism, a facial thing, whatever, every 3 seconds if you want to keep a live audience going. That's how often you have to be doing gestures, moving, something that keeps their attention, or you'll lose an audience just like that. And I knew that. I've been doing it a long time. And I went, and they're dying. They're laughing. They're thinking it's part of the show, you know. And it took me forever. It was probably 10 seconds, but up there on stage, it's like an hour, you know, trying to figure out what routine I was in the middle of. I don't tell jokes. I do routines, you know. When you break in the middle of a routine, you got to find your way back home. And I knew that night I was going to drink if I didn't get out of this business. So the last night I did it, it was in the Iverton Playhouse for a benefit for a girl with sarcoidosis. And we raised her $4,000 or $5,000. And Catherine Hepburn was the president of the association. And I had to talk to her, which was always a hoot. I've known her a long time. Art Carney came backstage after the show and, hey, really enjoyed your show, you know, and he signed something for me. And I got in my car, the limousine I sent home, and I had my car from soundcheck earlier that day. I had parked there, and the limo took me to the show with the rest of the comics. And I got a tux on. And on the way home, the muffler fell off my old Datsun B210. I've got a tux that I own underneath this car with a coat hanger at 11:30 at night, and this is my last show. And I said, this is perfect. And I'm sober at this point. And I said, this is perfect. This is just the way it's supposed to be, you know. So I'm underneath there with a tuxedo fixing my beat-up car with a coat hanger. So that's a good way to end that. So today, I sponsor people. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have a home group. It's Clover Group in Warrenton. We meet on Tuesdays and Saturdays. Tuesday's a step meeting, and Saturday is open discussion, except the first Saturday of the month, which is yesterday, which is a speaker's meeting. And please come and join us. And I'm involved in service. I've been an intergroup rep for a long time. I just dropped that recently because I've got too many other commitments. I'm in the middle of this will be my first solo album. I've been a drummer for 51 years on top of all that stand-up that I do. I'm doing a very Pink Floyd Yes-type album right now. I'm playing all the instruments. The first one I did the other day, I played 7 different instruments on it. And I have 3 sets of drums in my studio downstairs and a recording studio and bass and Les Pauls and Stratocasters and acoustic guitars, and I'm having a lot of fun. Sobriety is a blast, man. And my sponsees come over, and we talk. And I got my good friend Charlie. We went out to Vegas last year, went to the club, and caught a meeting down there. And I'm driving down there without Charlie, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to check this place out. And I got in the rented car, and I got down to where Caesar's Palace was, and I saw all these young couples holding hands. I'm by myself. And I said, you know what? This is not where I belong. Never even got out of the car. Just drove through. There were about 100 different lights, and just wait for the light. Turn around, made a big U-turn, came back to the hotel. I realized that, you know what? This is not where I need to be. I did a little gambling, lost, what, $15? And most of it was at the airport waiting for the plane to go back home. But we went to the Grand Canyon. We saw elk. We saw deer. We saw groundhogs? Groundhogs? Prairie dogs. I pulled out, we had breakfast at this place on Route 66, and it was, what the hell was the name of that place? Roadkill Cafe. And of course, you know, I'm figuring that's not going to be good food. It's the best food you ever want to eat. The pancakes were up to here, and, you know, big plate of home fries and coffee, and I couldn't finish them, so we decided to take the styrofoam thing, and we're on our way. And he had to go to the bathroom, and there's a little place out back of this place, and I bought this jewelry from a Navajo Indian. She was making jewelry right there, and I had these pancakes, and all of a sudden I look up, and there's a prairie dog, and so I threw him a piece of this pancake. Next thing you know, there's like 30 of them. They're coming out of holes everywhere, and they're all, you know, like this, and I'm throwing them, and they're just, I mean, it was amazing. And then someone would slam a door, and they go, zoof, and they all go back in their holes, and then they all pop back up, and they come over. It was magical. Sober, out in Vegas, went to a supercross race, because like I said, I used to be a motocross mechanic, and I still know a few people out there. Not many anymore. Most of them are gone, but I enjoyed the heck out of it. And I bought an RV. It's an old one. Wick fixed it up. I'm going to take that and do some road trips and go some races. I ride a Harley. It's getting a little harder every year to do it with the risks and the problems as we get older, and I have to make a decision on that pretty soon if I'm going to continue that, but it makes me feel young. I love it. I'm in a motorcycle, sober motorcycle group, ARM, Association of Recovering Motorcyclists, largest motorcycle club in the United, in the world. And we have chapters in 43 chapters in England, Denmark, Germany, Canada, and the United States. So we meet, and we go on these runs in Vermont, and we meet every year. And one of those times I went up there and I prayed in front of Bill Wilson's grave, and I thanked him for my life. I had 9 months. It was this time around. And there was a 24-hour chip sitting on that headstone. So I took my nine-month chip, and I put it there, and I took that 24-hour chip. And that's the one I carry, because all I have is today. It doesn't matter. You know, it was real difficult having, you know, double-digit sobriety and coming back and picking up a 24-hour chip. It's a very humbling thing to do. And it kills more alcoholics because of the pride they feel, and they can't face the people. But I want you all to know, if it ever happens to you, I hope it doesn't, but if it does, this is the best place to face people when stuff like that happens, because we only care that you get better. We don't care how many times it takes. It's not a contest. You know, the number is important. I know people that got 2 years and they've got everything I want. They got it, to, you know, they just, God has been, you know, whatever, just dialed it in. And I know people with 30 years and they're as crazy as a loon. I don't want anything that they got. And so it doesn't matter what the years are. It's what are you putting into it? You know, what are you getting out of it? What are you doing for the next person? You know, if you want the sobriety that is going to hit that inner soul, it's helping that next alcoholic who comes in the door. And not make an opinion or a judgment no matter how many times he goes in and out or how many white chips he has. Just as long as his breath, there's hope, keep coming back. It's not a contest, folks. It's life or death. And for me, it could have been death, you know. And I had the kind of people that I surrounded myself with that only want good things for me, and I only want good things for them. And I think we find that here in this group and a lot of others too. This is, you can't find an organization anywhere else in the world that is that feels that way. You know, the guys on the bottom are the big shots, and the guys on the top are the little shots. You know, we call the shots from the rooms, and you know, we tell New York what to do. It's a great way to live. And if it wasn't for AA, I know I wouldn't be standing here right now. And if I wasn't standing here right now, I'm not sure I'd want to be standing anywhere. So thank you.